From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you. Today on the program, we're going to be taking a look at an innovative new course in the humanities designed to inspire a love of learning in its students. We'll be speaking with Jean Cheney, Associate Director of the Utah Humanities Council.
There's nothing really magical about this. It's just a testimony to the fact that when people become empowered to use their minds, they start realizing for themselves what changes they can make and what changes they want to make in their lives.
But before that, we have your daily roundup of today's top local headlines, as well as a conversation with New York Times Supreme Court correspondent Adam Liptak on the state of Utah's changing legal position on same-sex marriage. All that coming up after these messages and Access Downtown on The Rundown here on KCPW. And thanks again for tuning in to The Rundown. As I mentioned in the introduction, later on in the program, we'll be having a conversation about humanities courses that are designed to transform the way people learn. But first up, we have these headlines. The state of Utah is reiterating its stance that a federal judge should throw out a lawsuit from animal welfare activists who accuse state legislators of enacting a law to prevent filming of agricultural operations to silence them. Court records show state attorneys filed a new motion last week saying the groups filing the lawsuit have not shown they face an immediate threat of criminal prosecution. The state first asked for the case to be thrown out in October. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals and the Animal League Defense Fund filed the lawsuit in July. They filed court papers in December saying that the law singles them out for punishment. The law makes it a misdemeanor to trespass on private property to record images or sounds of a livestock operation. Last Wednesday, clean air advocates lined up to give Utah's Division of Air Quality their 2 cents. At the DAQ's monthly board meeting, the board met to vote on a new State Implementation Plan, or SIP, designed to help the state meet the standards set by the Clean Air Act. Under the plan, emissions are expected to be cut by 4,600 tons by 2019. But the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as critics of the SIP, say the plan is too lenient with industry. Industry emissions may increase by 12% overall by 2019, and companies will be exempt from emissions standards during shutdowns, startups, and times when machinery malfunctions. The DAQ faced a barrage of opposition to the SIP during public comments. Attorney Joro Walker of the Utah Physicians for a Healthy Environment was critical of the state's plan to average out industry emissions readings.
How can emission limits that are averaged over 7 days or 365 days show compliance with a 24-hour standard? That's like trying to make sure that people slow down in a school zone by averaging their speed over the course of a week or over the course of 365 days. It doesn't work.
Chad Mullins, speaking as a private citizen, noted that the SIP rarely goes above and beyond federal clean air standards. He cited points made by Salt Lake City Mayor Ralph Becker during his State of the City address.
Do you all know that we have a state law that says our air quality standards here in Utah cannot be more strict than federal standards? Are we really okay with a standard that represents a passing grade for most other cities and states, but still allows us to fail? Since when are we as Utahns content with federal officials in Washington determining what is best for the people of Utah?
The meeting lasted for over 3 hours, ending with a 6-1 vote in favor of the proposal. Physician Robert Payne was the lone no vote. The state of Utah's legal arguments in the same-sex marriage debate have evolved over the course of its filings. This is according to an article published this morning by Adam Liptak, Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. I had a chance to speak with Liptak earlier today and asked him to outline the changing position of the state of Utah before the courts.
So whenever the government enacts a law that discriminates against a group of people, it has to have a reason. And Utah has put forward now 3 different reasons. The first, which is what they put forward in front of Judge Shelby, the trial judge, was that it was important to make sure straight people procreated responsibly. And that argument makes sense on one level. If you make marriage more attractive, you're more likely that people will have their kids within marriage, and kids may be better off as a consequence of that. Judge Shelby said that was true so far as it goes, but it wasn't clear to him why excluding gay and lesbian couples made that any less likely. So that was the responsible procreation argument. And interestingly, when the case made its way briefly to the Supreme Court in a successful effort to stay Judge Shelby's ruling, Utah officials threw that responsible procreation argument overboard. So for some reason, they lost faith in that first argument. And they essentially replaced it with a different argument, which in shorthand they call optimal parenting. That is, they say that kids are better off if they are raised by their biological parents, by a mom and a dad. And there, too, the brief on the other side says, that may be so. Maybe it's so, maybe it's not so. The scientific evidence, actually probably the weight of it, goes against it. But let's assume it's true. Not clear why letting forbidding gay and lesbian couples from marrying advances that interest. And then in their last brief in the Supreme Court, Utah officials refined this optimal parenting argument with something they called gender diversity, that just as we like to have a diverse student population in our colleges and universities, they said, it's a good idea to have gender diversity within parental units. So what's interesting is how the state's position has sort of shifted and evolved as it goes along.
Is that sort of a takeoff on affirmative action, and isn't that an unusual stance for a conservative state government to take?
A very nice point. Yeah, I was surprised to see them citing the leading affirmative action case on behalf of the argument against same-sex marriage. I hadn't seen that before, and I'm a pretty close reader of briefs in this area.
So you end your article today with a candid moment from one of the lawyers for the state attorney general's office here in Utah, Stanford Purser. Maybe you could lay out that moment for us.
So the basic question through all these arguments is, how does same-sex marriage hurt opposite-sex marriage? And the answer Mr. Purser gave was, we don't know. Too soon to tell. It's a new phenomenon. Maybe it helps. Maybe it hurts. We don't know. And that's probably the most candid answer. And that's not truly a concession. It may be that courts should move slowly in upsetting centuries of tradition, but it's an easier argument to grasp than responsible procreation, optimal parenting, and gender diversity.
Well, and maybe that's the next argument the state will make. Do you think it's likely that that this case, which is before the 10th Circuit Court and may be heard in March, we're not quite certain, will make its way back to the Supreme Court?
I think there's a reasonable prospect, but I might put it south of 50-50. The Supreme Court is not eager to be forced to decide the ultimate question for all 50 states, including conservative states like Utah or Mississippi or Alabama, whether there is or is not a constitutional right to same-sex marriage. I think the Supreme Court would rather this percolate some more. We're at 17 states now. I don't think they want to return to this until that number is much higher, but maybe they'll feel forced to return to it in this case.
And with other cases pending in other states challenging, the prohibition on same-sex marriage, are we likely to see more states added to that list soon, do you think?
The trend towards same-sex marriage will continue to expand, but much of the work in the most liberal states has already been done. So it's hard to know how quickly the map will expand. And what the Supreme Court would like to see, I'm guessing, is a map that looked like 1967 when it struck down bans on interracial marriage, where only 16 states continued to forbid interracial marriage. Hmm.
Adam Liptak is the Supreme Court correspondent for the New York Times. Adam, thanks very much for joining us today.
Great to be here.
And that's our local news summary for the day. I'm Roger McDonough. You're listening to The Rundown. Stay with us. A new course is helping underserved high school kids at Salt Lake's East High develop a love of learning. It's called the Clemente Course, and it's an interdisciplinary humanities course for sophomores who hope to be the first in their families to attend college. Students are immersed in discussions on philosophy, art history, literature, and history with college instructors. Today on The Rundown, we'll learn about this innovative program and about how engaging in the humanities can change lives with Jean Chaney, Associate Director of the Utah Humanities Council. Jean, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
So there's this new course, the Clemente Course, that the Utah Humanities Council has developed for underserved high school students. And I was hoping we could start by getting a better grasp of what the course is, as well as the origin of the thinking behind the course. Where did it come from, and what is the intent?
Sure. The course is a two-semester elective course for sophomores who are also in the AVID program at East, and that stands for Achievement via Individual Determination. It's a national program for underserved students. And the Clemente course is a course that is interdisciplinary, as you said, and there are five subjects that are touched on. In the fall, this fall, we've had philosophy and art history taught by professors from the University of Utah and teaching fellows as well. These are honors undergraduates who they themselves are first in their families to go to college, and as well as critical writing and thinking taught by Brooke Ibsen, who is at East High, an honors instructor there. And then in the spring, we're going to be having two professors from Westminster College, and they'll be teaching history and literature, again with teaching fellows from the honors program there, and Brooke will continue with the critical writing and thinking. And the idea behind this Clemente course is to sort of break down walls between high school and college, to inspire students to really think on their own. Philosophy engages them. It has engaged them in debates about such things as autocracy versus democracy, and students really have gotten into it. And the whole goal of the course is to excite students about their learning, to help them see that these things really matter, the questions that we talk about in school. And they stop seeing subjects in neat little boxes and start understanding that learning is tremendously interrelated and that it's of interest. And that's what's been happening.
I'm kind of curious about the typical student for a Clemente course. Is there any kind of profile? Where are they coming from? What is their background? It probably runs the gamut, actually.
Well, actually, in this particular class, the students are all either immigrants or sons or daughters of recent immigrants, or refugees. They're minority students, and we have students from Bosnia, from Somalia, many students from Mexico, and students who were born here but their parents immigrated. They're all students whose parents didn't go to college, and who probably without these programs would not find their way to college because they're not growing up in cultures or families who really understand the system here and what needs to happen in order to get into college and why college is so important. Their families are actually very, very supportive of them once they sort of learn how this all works. They're tremendously, I would call them talented students, but not necessarily the top students in the school. They're students who have shown promise, and they're students who are responding to this education extremely well.
And is that response because, a student who goes through one of these courses changes the way they see learning in general? What is it about these courses in particular? Or maybe you can describe what happens inside the course.
Well, I'll let a student answer that question. When we asked students at the end of the semester, and they're finishing their first semester, what has this experience been like for you? And she said, after so many years in school, and by sophomore year in high school, it feels like a long time in school. She said, this is really different. I'm being asked to tell what I think about things. And it's also different because of the teachers who come to teach them. These are college professors, and they have different expectations of students. I think the interdisciplinary nature of it really appeals to students. What do they do in class? They do a lot of discussion. They read texts closely. They have in art history, they've studied the history of public art, trying to answer the question, can art change lives? Can art change people? And in philosophy, they have read Aristotle. They've studied the philosophical questions in the Odyssey, and they end up debating in class issues that really matter to them. And the students are telling us, sometimes for the first time, not always, but sometimes for the first time, they feel that this education is really mattering now. It's mattering right now. It seems important, and they're getting a taste of what might be ahead in college. And frankly, it excites them.
Can you tell, there's an origin to the thinking behind this kind of course, and it comes from social critic and writer Earl Shoris, who died just in 2012. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about Earl Shoris and his role in seeing this happen.
Earl Shores has been key to this whole effort. And by the way, we're the second state in the country who has offered the Clemente course. It began in Chicago. Earl's idea, really for the latter 20 years of his life, is that the humanities have been the province or the luxury that the elite have been able to enjoy in higher education. Things like philosophy and literature and history, the formal study of these subjects, are recognized by wealthy people and by people who are privileged as being extremely important to a rich life and to a successful life. But people who are poor or people who have grown up without those advantages and don't have access to higher education typically don't have the chance to do these studies. And he sees them and has seen evidence that that really disadvantages them in all sorts of ways. They tend to not be able to recognize the power of their own minds. They tend not to have the voices in their communities that they should have and could have. And so he really dedicated his life to bringing the humanities to people, both adults and now high school students, who are underserved and may not recognize that the humanities are key to their futures. You know, we typically talk about the importance of math and science, and they're tremendously important to a successful life in the 21st century. But so are the humanities, and he recognized that. And he also recognized that that tends not to be thought of as important for people who are in their lower incomes, and he really struggled and fought against that.
You know, you mentioned science and technology, and I know that here in the state of Utah, this makes me think of how the state of Utah has put a lot of money into getting students ready for careers, and a lot of the focus has been on, you know, so-called STEM courses. That's science, tech, engineering, and math. Is that focus? You know, what are the obstacles to what you're doing, and are the humanities seen as not "quote unquote" job creating?
Well, I think, in a very short-sighted way, they may be. We're not trying to encourage necessarily PhDs in history or literature or philosophy through these courses, but whether you're studying science, biology, chemistry, or math, you need to be able to think critically and carefully, and the humanities help that. They also help people understand more fully what it means to be a human being. And you're a human being your whole life. And to be able to understand more of the subtleties, nuances, and complexity of what it means to be a human being and being in relationship and understanding what and benefiting from the tremendous richness that's in the humanities to help that understanding, I think it's just extremely short-sighted and narrow-minded to exclude that education from the essential education that a young person receives. Science and math are tremendously important. There's no question about that. But so are history and literature and philosophy. They are critical to being able to think well and fully. And I might also add that they often talk about questions related to ethics. And I don't think we need to look very far to see the great need in our world for a closer understanding of the importance of living a moral, ethical life.
You know, you mentioned that Earl Shores, his idea started with working with adults. And maybe I'll use that as a segue into another program that you guys are involved in, which is the Venture Course. It's essentially the same idea, but for adults who have, I'm not certain if this is right, but maybe adults who have conceivably given up on the idea of getting a college education.
No, that's true. I think that's true. Venture is geared towards adults living on low incomes. The age range is 18 to 60, and we've had students, both of those ages, take the course. We're in our ninth year offering Venture in three places in Utah, one in Salt Lake, one in Ogden, and one in Cedar City, and we partner with different educational institutions in all three of those sites. In Salt Lake, it's with Westminster College, and in Ogden, it's with Weber State, and Cedar City with SUU. The idea behind Venture is that it's very similar to Clemente, is that humanities are, you might think of them as the keys to the kingdom. They are the ways that people open doors for themselves, for their minds. And in Venture, we see students who may have never thought of themselves as thinkers and come out realizing that they definitely are, that they have a voice in their community. Some go on to finish college. In fact, we have students who are in graduate school now who have gone through the venture course. And some go on to have new jobs or we've had Head Start teachers, aides in Head Start programs bring art history to the Head Start program. We've had students who graduate from venture and start their own nonprofits. The range is very wide, but the idea is that they get very involved in their communities, and it's all done through the humanities. That's what they're studying, the same five subjects. Mm-hmm. And they study them for two semesters with college professors, and they get credit for the study.
Maybe you could give us an example of a story of someone from the venture program, you know, who's maybe an unexpected success.
Well, I'd love to tell you a story about a student right now who's in the course, and he's in his early 40s. He's never had a chance to go to college. And he's a wonderful writer and excited about writing. And this course has just been like a fire in him. And he said, you know, basically, what can I do now? And so I've been steering him towards Westminster College because they're our community partner, academic partner in this effort. And so he's already interviewed at Westminster. He's filled out an application. He's applying for a four-year scholarship. This wouldn't have happened without the venture course. And all along, he had the talent and the ability, but for a variety of reasons, he never found a way to go to college. And now he does. We have a student right now in Chicago at Loyola University who's in graduate school. And she's another, when I think about the impact of venture, she was a breast cancer survivor, African-American woman who lived in poverty and had many, many strikes against her. She found the venture course and just very, very sort of piece by piece put a totally different life together for herself. She went to Westminster, was a huge success there, a McNair Scholar, graduated with honors, and now she's in graduate school in social work. And so there's nothing really magical about this. It's just a testimony to the power that or to the fact that when people become empowered to use their minds, they start realizing for themselves what changes they can make and what changes they want to make in their lives. And it's exciting to watch.
Here's a question, I guess, referring both to this program and more generally, are the humanities underfunded? I guess is another question.
Well, of course, I think they're underfunded. I should say, though, there are people who do recognize the power of the humanities. People who are head of foundations and corporations. And so we do enjoy support for these programs from a variety of sources, including all of our partners. Everyone's contributing to these efforts. I think people who sort of get it, who understand the power of the humanities, realize that programs like this are absolutely critical. And so they do get in back of them. I've never seen a sort of a comparison study of support for the humanities now in terms of in higher education, which I'm really not directly linked to. I think there is trouble getting support for the humanities. But I think what's a bigger problem is the recognition on the part of policy leaders and policymakers of the importance and to some extent of even some people in education. I think they sort of may lose the awareness of how critical this education is to one's whole life and the trajectory of one's life.
Right. There's, you know, the sort of sense of a classical education of getting an education for education's sake, because in the end, this is about your personal development as opposed to, the salary you might make one day.
You know, I don't separate those. Because I think if you develop as a person, you're going to develop professionally and in the world. I think it's really misleading and a mistake to see this as only sort of personal enrichment. What I've seen as a result of these two programs is that people get empowered. And that's maybe an overused word, but people suddenly start having much more ambition about all sorts of areas of their life. And we've had people graduate from the venture course who become scientists. And so it's not an either-or thing. It's when we're talking about education, we really need to look at the whole person. And when your mind starts to becomes on fire, it can become on fire for lots of enterprises. And it's not just limited to the study of whatever may have been the catalyst for that fire.
Right. I'm wondering if there are specific success stories. Of course, the East High School program is a pilot program.
Right.
In its first year, right? I mean,
it is, and we hope to replicate it elsewhere in Utah. Yeah, it's very early to talk about success stories, but I can tell you that I've seen young people who've started the year very timid, very quiet, with a fair amount of uncertainty about what they had just signed on for. And these are elective courses, so they signed on for it. And now they're telling us, basically, bring it on. We want to do it again. And so there's going to be an 11th grade year. And I've seen them speak in front of adults, and they're confident. They were talking about college before, but now they're talking about college with a lot more conviction. They sort of have a sense of what it's all about. So, yeah, I'm a believer because the students are showing that. They are recognizing that when they go to school, they're learning things that nobody can take away from them. It comes into them. They become changed.
You know, we'll have to check back with you, too, in the future and see how.
Sure.
That'd be great. But maybe we could talk for just a moment about the Council itself, the Humanities Council itself, and its mission. What is the charge of the Humanities Council? How is it funded in general here in Utah? You have more than these two programs. What is the scope of
your
programs?
Yeah. The Humanities Council has actually changed its mission somewhat recently, and we are empowering groups and individuals to use the humanities to improve their communities. We really are focusing on community improvement and working with others to make it happen. We're a small organization, and we're statewide. We have 8 full-time staff members and fairly small budget. So we're leveraging our resources and using our commitment to the humanities to work with other people in communities to help have a targeted change. And in the case of the programs we've been talking about, it means helping people use education to access a richer life. But we also do museum programs. We do oral history programs, a lot of book programs, with the intent of showing a specific community improvement as a result of this engagement using the humanities.
Well, Jean Cheney, we could probably talk for quite a while about a number of topics. Jean Cheney, Associate Director of the Utah Humanities Council, thanks for coming in.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
That was Jean Cheney, Associate Director of the Utah Humanities Council. To find out more, including the programs we highlighted today, visit utahhumanities.org. I'm Roger McDonough. You've been listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back. And thanks again for tuning in to KCPW's news and issues show, The Rundown. Our program was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tune in each weekday at 5 p.m. for an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are next.